From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Alyssa Block. We live in a world of seemingly infinite choices. Press the remote, you can watch documentaries, cartoons, dramas, talent shows. Click the mouse, you can play video games, read news, listen to music, watch movies, or chat with friends. Today we begin a series on how this fracturing of the media has fundamentally changed the way we experience culture. NPR's Elizabeth Blair gets us started. So what is this called?
The academic word for this is disintermediation.
Casey Ray Hunter heads up the Future of Music Coalition.
But that's a mouthful, so fractured culture works just fine.
Fractured implies that something is broken, it's wounded.
Alyssa Rosenberg writes a column for The Atlantic. She prefers another word.
The fragmentation of culture is a wonderful thing.
And Mark Lopez of the Pew Hispanic Research Center was just confused when I asked him about fractured culture.
I was actually going to ask you what it means. I wasn't sure exactly what it means.
But he took a stab at it, explaining the fracturing he sees in the Latino population.
For example, young Latinos are straddling two different cultures. They're straddling a culture of their immigrant roots, but also an American culture as well.
And what's popular with one group can go virtually unnoticed by another. Univision, for example, is watched by millions of Latinos in the U.S., but millions of other Americans couldn't tell you what channel it's on.
Don Julio! Don Julio, por Dios, ¿qué le pasa? Doña Marcela, ¿qué hacemos?
TV ratings offer glaring proof of how the once mass market has split up into lots of smaller crowds. Since we're not all watching the same shows, those water cooler moments are harder to come by. Dan Schneider, a TV veteran and executive producer for Nickelodeon, says take a show like Modern Family.
Okay, ready? One, two, three.
A really great comedy that's popular and new that's on the air right now.
Nothing's happening!
Oh, my God!
Yeah, our kids walked in on us.
But if you go walk around the streets or if you go walk around a mall and say, hey, did you see last week's Modern Family? You know, how many people out of 10 are going to say, oh, yeah, I saw it? The television markets are so niche that even a popular show isn't watched by, you know, most people that you're going to run into.
There is no one dominant cultural conversation. The music industry, same thing. Casey Ray Hunter of the Future of Music Coalition says this fragmentation has opened up the world for creators and consumers alike.
The arrival of the internet, to some degree, leveled the playing field. And that allowed, a plethora of folks who otherwise would have had no shot of getting on, say, commercial radio to be heard. It's really an amazing time to be a fan.
It's ushering in a totally different era of communications.
Faye Ferguson is co-CEO of Burrell Communications, an African-American ad agency founded 40 years ago.
Based on the principle that black people are not dark-skinned white people.
And says Ferguson that African Americans are a separate, viable market. She says there have always been many American cultures.
This has always existed, but technology has been an enabler. So that now there's actually a way to get to these smaller groups efficiently.
She says targeted marketing is the name of the game now more than ever. So are we at risk of losing a common culture in such a fractured society? Alyssa Rosenberg of The Atlantic says maybe, but she also thinks it will make us appreciate the mass cultural events that do occur even more, like the end of the Harry Potter series, or when Michael Jackson died.
I'm gonna make a change for once in my life.
His death affected millions, whether you were a fan or a former fan or just recognized his influence.
It was enormous because we were united in a way that we aren't normally. It added significance to the event.
If Michael Jackson were coming of age now, could he become the king of pop? Probably not. The once monolithic record companies have lost their power. The fractured media has made it easy for people to discover all kinds of new talent, or even learn about artists from other cultures they never knew existed, just by changing the channel. Elizabeth Blair, NPR News.
Asian Americans have never been a big enough or cohesive enough fragment of the culture to support a whole TV network like BET or Univision, but now online video is a vibrant alternative to television. And that means a fan base of mostly Asian teens is enough to support a new kind of star. Corey Takahashi reports.
At the moment, there's one YouTube celebrity with more subscribers than anyone else. Not Lady Gaga, not Justin Bieber either.
First things first, I'm not your average teenager. I never got to
more than 3 million fans on YouTube have signed up to receive updates and videos from a college student who was raised in Hilo, Hawaii. His name is Ryan Higa.
As long as I can remember, I've been training to become an ass, an agent of secret stuff.
Higa's latest 35-minute movie is called Agents of Secret Stuff. It's an action comedy set in high school. It features a who's who of YouTube celebrities. The video's clocked well over 8 million views in the past 2 months.
You must operate cautiously. I will not fail. Cool. Peace out.
A Pasadena-based production house, Wong Fu Productions, directed, co-wrote, and co-produced the project with Higa. Philip Wang is a co-founder, and he also acts in the movie.
People, especially through YouTube, they're finding types of entertainment that are just from people that are just like themselves, or people that they can relate to a little bit better than, you know, some unattainable movie star or TV star. And so when they see people like Ryan, or they see people like us, you know, it's someone that they feel a more personal connection to.
Stars like Ryan Higa can earn up to six-figure incomes a year based on ads YouTube pairs with their videos.
It's not all a Hollywood ecosystem anymore.
George Strompolos used to cultivate online video talent in his former job at YouTube. Now he's working with many of the same stars as a producer in Los Angeles.
For whatever reason, the studio system is not creating, in this case, Asian-American celebrities. So fans of Ryan have actually elevated him to that level through their own means. In this case, that's through YouTube and through the internet.
But even Philip Wang of Wong Fu Productions will admit one downside to this newer pathway to stardom.
We have lost a little bit of that classy kind of stars, you know, from, you know, the Frank Sinatra or Gene Kelly age.
As old Blue Eyes might say, in the YouTube age, it's even more about doing it my way. For NPR News, I'm Corey Takahashi.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Melissa Block. This week and next, we're featuring a series of stories about how there's no longer one dominant cultural conversation in the U.S. The explosion of internet outlets and TV channels means it's harder for any one star to get everyone's attention. Today, NPR's Netta Ulaby reports on one man who's trying to figure out how to dominate across platforms.
Steve Harvey did everything he could to be as famous as someone like Bill Cosby. He hosted Showtime at the Apollo. He starred in 2 sitcoms.
Well, hello, Mr. Highwire.
My name ain't no Highwire.
Harvey has written 2 New York Times best-selling books, and millions of people have seen him host the game show Family Feud.
Let's clear the board,
and Harvey remains a formidable presence on the stand-up circuit, as seen in the documentary The Original Kings of Comedy.
I wanna be free.
But the cornerstone of Steve Harvey's fame today is the nationally syndicated radio and TV show that airs in 64 markets.
Good morning, everybody. You are listening to The Voice. Come on, dig me now. One and only Steve Harvey.
Every weekday at dawn, at 5 o'clock in the morning, Harvey makes a grand entrance at his Atlanta production studio.
There he is.
His production staff goes a little nuts. It's an office ritual. The makeup artists start a cheer. Harvey's show reaches 7 million people, but Harvey knows millions more have never heard of him. After the show, he takes an elevator 7 stories above the studio to an opulent wood-paneled office with floor-to-ceiling windows. He steeples his fingers and says he wants to leave show business.
I want my fame that I paid for, that it cost me so dearly to have. I want it to pay off.
Harvey wants to leverage his fame into entrepreneurship. Men's suits, grocery stores, a dating website, energy-efficient light bulbs. He says it's protection for when people tire of him.
Throw me off to the side, dish me off like I'm a dish rag, throw me in the sink. No, man, I'm wringing this puppy out. We're getting all the moisture out of this fame that's so difficult to acquire and costs so much to attain and maintain. You're not throwing me away.
As we talk, Harvey's eyes constantly flick from his heavy carved desk and towards a flat-screen TV. It does nothing but flash the comedian's long-term goals, like listen to the voice, stay prayerful.
I want to become one of the premier motivational speakers. I'm going to break out of the entertainment world, become one of the leading businessmen. My yearly income goal is to make $250 million a year. I'm nowhere close to that, but that's the goal.
Steve Harvey grew up in the projects in Cleveland. He's a workaholic who started doing stand-up when he was 27. For years, he ground out gigs in clubs across the United States.
If you name me the city, I can, without anything, tell you how to get there.
Okay. Montgomery, Alabama.
Man, you take 85 over to Montgomery, you catch 65, and you go south to the 10. If you ask me how to get to Kansas, I'm going to tell you from here to take 20, go up to 40, take 40 across till it turns into 70, and you'll hit Kansas. Or I can get you to Vermilion, South Dakota from here.
But Harvey's had more trouble finding a roadmap to a multiracial fan base. His sitcom, The Steve Harvey Show, ran for 6 years. It got decent ratings, NAACP awards, but it never found Cosby-like traction beyond black audiences. When he got a book deal based on relationship advice he gives during his show, his publishers tried to keep him in that niche.
They were convinced at HarperCollins that this was for black women. And when I sent the book in, they were putting stuff in it like, sisters, let me tell y'all, and black women gotta stay together. Whoa, I didn't say that. No, take all that out.
Men are men and women are women, says Harvey. So his books are for everyone.
I think he does a fabulous job of getting people talking.
Tanya Ladipo is a psychotherapist. Her clients are mostly African American. It surprised her how often her appointments start with a question.
Did you hear Steve Harvey's show this morning?
That's their in, a way to start talking about their problems. Ladipo does not always agree with Harvey's advice, but she says, take him as a comedian, not a mental health professional. At a moment when relationship success is critical to Steve Harvey's brand, an ex-wife has been publicly unhappy about their divorce. On Harvey's show, he discussed his mistakes with his on-air sidekicks.
I done got it wrong a lot of times. Mm-hmm. Hey, man, I got a divorce. Hey, man, I stepped out on my girl.
But then Harvey started talking about his upcoming national tour with Kirk Franklin, one of gospel's biggest stars. It's called the Ain't Nobody Perfect Tour. Harvey promised his co-hosts and his audience the tour would make them laugh, not chuckle.
What's a what chuckle, Steve? What's a laugh?
Laugh is when you hit the people you roll with.
Hitting the people you roll with. In a fragmented media culture, that's pretty much the definition of success. Netta Ulaby, NPR News.
Let's go next to the Sundance Film Festival, a showcase of independent films. Our reviewer Kenneth Turan is at Sundance in Park City, Utah, and he's on the line. Ken, welcome to the program once again.
Good to be here.
What are you watching?
A lot of films.
Well, let's talk about dramatic films first. What stands out for you?
Well, you know, the one that really stands out for me is a film called Like Crazy. It's a romance. It stars Anton Yelchin and Felicity Jones, a young British actress. And, you know, so many romances, you feel like you're watching characters. With this film, because of the way it was made, you really feel like you're watching real people. The emotional connection in this film is really intense.
How do they manage that?
Well, the director, Drake Dramus, has a background in improvisation, but it's an unusual kind of improvisation. He starts with, like, two typed pages of information for every scene. And then the actors improvise off of this really detailed outline.
Oh,
you would never guess it's improvised. I am not a fan of improvisation, but this film really makes this method work.
I understand there's also a film at the Sundance Film Festival that stars Paul Giamatti, a star for many people.
Yes. It's called Win-Win. It's another one of my favorites in the festival. It's directed by a guy named Tom McCarthy, who people may remember from The Visitor, from Station Agent. He makes these kind of offbeat films, kind of. He really is in love with the kind of deliciousness of human complexities. And Paul Giamatti plays a lawyer who cuts a moral corner and, you know, comes to feel that, well, maybe this wasn't such a great idea.
This is also a business occasion, right? Because you have people who might actually buy these films and distribute these films if they love what they see at Sundance.
Absolutely. And the business has been really stronger this year than in previous years. In fact, the film I mentioned, Like Crazy, was the subject of a bidding war between several companies. The negotiations, I was told, went on to like 5:45 in the morning all night, which is a Sundance tradition, before it was sold. And it was sold to a major studio. It was sold to Paramount, which is highly unusual.
This is kind of an amazing scene that you describe. It reminds me of old stories of political conventions from generations ago. Everybody would show up and nobody would really know who the presidential nominee was going to be. That's how they're buying and selling films at Sundance?
It really is. It's like the Wild West. It really works that way. You know, there are different people shuttle around from different hotel rooms. I mean, it's as dramatic often as anything on screen. Sometimes it's more dramatic than what's on the screen.
I feel compelled to mention, when I say the title of this next film, this documentary, I'm just saying the title here, The Redemption of General Butt Naked.
I know. I mean, I don't know what it sounds like. It sounds like a joke. It sounds silly, but it's an absolutely amazing film. General Butt Naked is a real person. He was a feared militia leader during the Liberian Civil Wars. He did awful things. And at a certain point during the war, he really experienced a conversion. He became an evangelical Christian. And the filmmakers spent 5 years off and on with him. And the film doesn't really take sides. It just presents this man, and this is a very unusual man.
So what are you still waiting to see, Ken Tran?
Well, there are a couple of other documentaries I wanted to mention. There's a documentary about a man named Buck Brannaman, who was the original horse whisperer, the guy the novel was based on, who does extraordinary things with horses. And, you know, he says, people have horse problems, and I end up dealing with the horse's people problems. And the other film with an animal in it is another great documentary called Project NIMH. Mm-hmm. This is made by James Marsh, who did Man on Wire, that people might remember. This is about an experiment that happened in the 1970s when a, like, infant chimpanzee was taken from his parents and raised by a human family with the hope that he would learn sign language and be able to communicate with humans. And the experiment was really on the people as much as the chimpanzee. The way that people responded to the chimpanzee, what they did, what it showed about them is just fascinating.
Ken Tran reviews movies for Morning Edition and the Los Angeles Times. Ken, always a pleasure to talk with you.
Likewise, Steve. Thank you.